multimedia production by Laurie DeMaron about being more mindful of our actions. Also performing will be special guest Eva Riversong of Portland's local band Soul Nectar. Again, that's What Can I Do? Spaceship Earth, October 4th at 5 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next 3-year strategic plan. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We have been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KBOO Strategic Planning Support Work Group, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kboo.fm/planRFP2015.
Think of home. Where there's love overflowing. I wish I was home. I wish I was back there with the things I've been knowing. When that makes the tall trees bend into leaning, suddenly the snowflakes that fall have a meaning. Sprinkling the sea makes it all clean. Maybe there's a chance for me to go back now that I have some direction. It would sure be nice to be back home where there's and just maybe I can convince time to slow up, giving me enough time in my life to grow up. Time, be my friend, let me start again.
Suddenly my good morning. And welcome to the October edition of Black Book Talk. This is Patricia Welch, the Library Lady.
And Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
And Obie Hill of Let's Read, Walk, and Talk.
And we are pleased to welcome to Black Book Talk today Robin Cost Lewis, the writer of Voyage of the Sable Venus and Other Poems, which is a book of poetry. Welcome to Black Book Talk.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here, truly. Thank you.
We wanted to start off with you reading a selection from your work so that our readers will be more familiar and will know why we're delighted to have you here.
Certainly. I'm going to read from a sequence of poems that is actually based on the film The Wiz. And this poem is called Glinda the Good. It's based on the character that Lena Horne played in The Wiz, Glinda the Good Witch of the South. And it's simply called Glinda the Good for Lena Horne. Pray there's something like her, something hovering above us in whose palm everything spins. Pray the stars are all the feelings we refuse to love, and somehow they have forgiven us a refusal to address them by their animal names.
Now, that was fairly short. Would you like to do another one?
Sure. I'll read the poem right next to it called Summer. Speaking of animals. Summer, Last summer, two discreet young snakes left their skin on my small porch two mornings in a row. Being postmodern now, I pretended as if I did not see them nor understand what I knew to be circling inside me. Instead, every hour I told my son to stop with his incessant back chat, I peeled a banana and cursed God, his arrogance, his gall, to still expect our devotion after creating love and mosquitoes. I showed my son the papery dead skin so he could know too what it feels like when something shows up at your door twice, telling you what you already know.
Thank you.
Yes, my pleasure.
I want to say first that the cover of the book is absolutely wonderful. It looks like a sepia print old photo.
Isn't it beautiful? It's actually the famous writer from the South, Eudora Welty, who not many people know had a fantastically productive photography practice. And one of the main things she photographed were Black people around Mississippi mostly. She just left a large oeuvre of work that is exquisite in every way. And this is one of the images from that body of work.
Beautiful.
Now that looks Isn't like it it's from the 1930s.
Yes, absolutely, sir. It's 1932.
Right.
Right. And there's a little story behind it. I don't know if you have time to hear, but the story behind it is that originally she called it underwear. Presumably the woman on the cover is shopping, or at least admiring some underwear in the shop window. But then it got changed by a curator to window shopping. I love it because, you know, just as an image, it's exquisite in its composition and in its subject matter, but also because it's so rare in Western art and in American photography in general to see or find a representation of a Black woman in the state of contemplation, actually
yes.
thinking, performing the act of thinking and being introspective. And the fact that presumably if she is looking at underwear, she's being contemplative of something as both quotidian and sublime as a nice lingerie made it even more important to me. And I really am grateful that Eudora Welty, you know, thought this an important picture to include in her work.
Especially during that time period, yes.
Right?
Okay.
Exactly.
But now we're going to get past the cover. We can talk about it. Folks, if you could see this cover, you would understand why. When you see this cover, you will understand why.
I wanted to ask about the two poems, The Mothers, that
you
wrote for Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yes. So The Mothers is a rewrite of Gwendolyn Brooks's canonical poem, Kitchenette Building, which is this exquisite poem. And as you know, Gwendolyn Brooks is, I'm a devotee of Gwendolyn Brooks. And as you know, she spent a lot of her work writing as much about the realities of women, Black women, as she did about race relations in America. Elizabeth Alexander has noted in one of her essays that it's something that we don't talk enough about. In any case, I decided, and I was very afraid to write this poem, to imagine what would it be like if I took the Kitchenette Building poem by Gwendolyn Brooks and thought about the inhabitants a little bit more. Gwendolyn Brooks' poem is concerned, of course, with how hard it is to be politically organized and engaged when you don't know when your next meal is coming from, or when you don't know, you know, how you're going to get to work, and rightly so. And even so, you know, as we all know, the civil rights movement proved that we could do that and change the world too. But I wanted to push a little further into the realm of pleasure and to see how did perhaps some people during this time also find joy and pleasure within a very complicated situation. So I reimagined that there were two mothers who were also lovers living within the Kitchenette Building, and they only got to meet every now and then in bathroom number 5, which is kind of character space within Gwendolyn Brooks' original poem. You know, it's a kitchenette building, so there are shared bathrooms, so everyone has to kind of wait for their turn to use the bathroom, every family. And so I also wanted to kind of playfully suggest that lovers also had to wait their turn for that bathroom as well.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Now, thank you. Your background, you're down in California now, but I detect in some of the reading your background a little Cajunism.
Did you say Cajun as in C-A-J-U-N?
Yes, ma'am.
Is that what you said? Yes, sir. Well, I will say it's a little Afro-Creolismo. my family is from New Orleans for sure, for generations. I mean, as far back as the early 18th century. Yeah, both sides.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I've only been to New Orleans a few times, but I just feel like New Orleans truly is one of those special places in this country. That there really is a different culture in New Orleans, and I just feel that the people who have grown up there and who love it and know it well, that it just becomes a part of their life. Has the fact that your family is from New Orleans, I don't know if that's really the correct way to say it. I just enjoy it. But do you think that's had some effect on your art? On the course.
Oh my God! Yes, okay. Everyone. Well, first of all, I should say if you didn't want me to talk about the cover for too long, we shouldn't bring up New Orleans because I could talk about New Orleans and Louisiana history for eons.
Don't worry. We are all like we all have Southern roots, so we know how to be firm but polite. Oh. We will stop you when we need to, but you go on and talk.
I will try not to go around the corner to go next door, as my dad would say. I've already forgotten the question. I'm having such a good time.
Talk about. Go on. You got it. I came back to you. Go on.
My family is from New Orleans for generations, as I said, and it certainly shows up in my work. The way it shows up, I think, I'll try to, whittle it down into themes. The way I think it shows up the most is that I grew up in a family, so I'm a child of the Great Migration. My siblings and me were born in Compton, California, after my parents and all their friends, came to Louisiana from New Orleans after World War II. My father was a World War II vet, as were most of the men that he grew up with. They were teenagers at the time when they were drafted. New Orleans was always this mythical kind of place that we always understood to be our true home, and we went back there often. But more than that, our relationship to blackness was a very vast and pleasurable site of culture for us. And I have bemoaned often how it seems to me, at least, blackness has become more and more narrow as the years have gone on. So, for example, there could be 20 people standing in the room, they could all be siblings, and nobody looked like, right? Not a person. And yet, except they all had like the same arch of an eyebrow, or their right pinky finger was crooked in the same kind of way. And there was also, so that's one thing that I always feel very grateful for, because I feel like my idea of what blackness is and can be is much vaster than the kind of traditional ideas of what it means to be African American in this country. It's just larger. I think it also has to do with the fact that Louisiana is such an international place historically. Yes. And so, I was always made aware by my father, especially, that we had tons of relatives in the Caribbean. I mean, and my father was very playful, so he didn't necessarily mean blood relatives. He just meant that our kind of cultural landscape was much larger than America would have us believe. At all times, that was always the case.
But
go ahead.
Go ahead. One of the things that impresses me whenever I go to New Orleans and when I meet folks from New Orleans also is that folks from New Orleans understand that you can bring the pleasure as you bear the pain, that pleasure is a part of life, but culturally the depiction of African Americans generally is one of strife. If it's strife, it's all strife, it's all pain.
Right.
And people don't remember, and I think sometimes some of us don't remember, that no matter what, in the midst of whatever is going on, that there is, and it's okay for there to be, moments of pleasure, moments of joy, and that we need those, and we need to talk about those too, that our life experience, our political and cultural experience is not just pain and suffering and struggle. It has not been that. There have still been those wonderful, delicious moments in life along with everything else. And I think folks in New Orleans, you know, you see folks second line and whatever, or telling you about how they'd stop to have a drink on the at every other bar on the way to work during Mardi Gras. It's like, whoa, now this is a different way of life, but it looks like a whole lot of fun.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you guys noticed, but my book is dedicated to beauty. It's for beauty. And I'm it's a very serious dedication. It's not meant to be frivolous in any way. It's more of an anthem, right? You know, we need pleasure. We need beauty. We need joy. I always admire the older people in my family because they went through an amazing amount of pain. Is a light word to describe what they went through growing up in the South, you know, being born, say, in the late 19th century, early 10s, right? I mean, they saw everything. And yet they seemed to me to be always the ones ready to shake a leg or have a drink or fetch wine or have a party or have a fete. And I used to say to my father all the time, I don't understand, because he and I were very close, that you went through all these things you went through and then was drafted and then went to World War II and came back. And, you know, the army was segregated and then you came back and then these things were happening and you are so happy. I don't understand it. And my father would always say to me, you know, he used some expletives that I can't use right now, but he would always say, you know, this is how you survive.
Yes.
The joy is how you survive. So to make light of pleasure as anything other than a political tool of survival, I think misses the point of how powerful joy and pleasure can be.
Yes.
And certainly I get that from my family without doubt. I mean, I'm always a person in the middle of a tragedy that will just start laughing. I mean, while the tragedy is occurring, I laugh inappropriately, but it's really because it's life happening in its most richest kind of manifestation. And we have to understand. We can't get through it unless we hold each other with love and joy and keep stepping. And if you guys picked that up in my book, I'm really grateful. That was very important to me. And I said to my editor, Deb Garrison at Knopf, the thing that this book must have is Black joy. And if it doesn't have it, we can't do it.
So when did you know you were a poet? Were you one of those children, students who wrote poems all the time?
You know, it's funny. I knew I wanted to be a writer since as long as I could remember. I just did not know what it meant. And speaking of the large Louisiana diaspora, I had an aunt who lived in Paris. We were in Compton, and she was in Paris. She was from Baton Rouge, and she came to visit when we were about six. And she asked me, because I was always reading all the time, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, a writer. But I didn't know what it meant, you know? I mean, there were no models around us for what it meant to be a writer. And she walked me to the store. I remember L.A., this part of L.A. still had dirt sidewalks. We didn't have any sidewalks. And I was ashamed because I didn't want her pretty Parisian shoes to get messed up. And she took me to the store and bought me a notebook and a pencil and brought me home. And she made me write, I, Robin Lewis, today will begin a novel. And I didn't know what a novel was, of course. But I've never forgotten that. And I get teary-eyed every time I think about it because it was yet again one of those moments where, you know, a Black grown-up takes a Black child's intellectual and aesthetic development seriously. My parents, of course, did. They were constantly giving me books because, of course, we didn't have a real library at our school. There was no library in our town. And, yes, we are talking about Los Angeles. There was no real library in our vicinity, you know. And so my parents supplied me with any books I wanted to, which was a great remarkable accomplishment, because my father was at first a janitor, then he became a forklift operator, and my mother was a housewife, and so we didn't have a lot of money. I remember the lights being turned off at times, you know, but yet speaking of the power of Black joy and Black pleasure, I never in my childhood can remember going without a book I wanted. My parents were constantly giving it to me, and so we did not know. My parents, we talked about it, we don't know, how do you become a writer? I could, like, I don't know. But they, nevertheless, any book I wanted, they gave to me. So I read voraciously as a child. My siblings still teach me, like, you know, tease me. They're going to go to see the Isley Brothers, and I want to stay home and read a book.
Yeah, that's a book person.
That kind of thing.
You're listening to Black Book Talk on KBOO. I remember my grandmother saying to me, Now, boy, you get the line, and I'll get the pole. We'll go down to the crawdad hole. Could you explain that?
Yes, sir. Can I explain the song, or can I explain the meaning of the line?
Both.
I mean, both. Well, my understanding is that we work together, right? And then we will have something to sustain our lives. It's also a fantastic song. The melody and the rhythm, it's very, it's filled with an incredible kind of vivacity to it. That's my understanding of the song, and I love that you brought it up. My father used to sing it all the time. Yeah.
Oh, I wish we'd known about this song. That could have been our outro. We'll find. What's the name of the song, Obi? You know, it's just...
I don't know the name, but it's just everybody knows. You get a line, I get a pole, honey.
Okay, we'll find that, and if we find it, we'll play it on the show, okay?
Yeah.
In fact, we can play it because you're going to be on a tour, and Portland, Oregon is one of the places that the publisher is sending you to.
Yes, sir. I'm coming to Portland. I'm very excited because I'm really interested in the history of Black people along the Pacific Rim of the United States. And I've been to Portland just once, but I'm coming for Woodstock at the Portland Museum of Art. I think it's November 7th.
It is Saturday, November 7th. Yes.
Yeah, I'm excited. I hope to see you guys. I really want to meet you in person.
You will see us, and Woodstock is just a very, very well-loved, well-attended event. So you're going to see a whole lot of folks. A lot of our listeners hopefully will be there, and just book people in Portland.
Fantastic.
We'll be coming out to say
hi to you.
You
know, Rowan Ricardo Phillips, who's another poet who's nominated for the National Book Award, will also be there. We're on a panel together. And then Tracy K. Smith, who's also a poet, will be there, although this year she's nominated for a National Book Award for her memoir. She's going to be in attendance too, amongst other writers. It seems like it's going to be a fantastic festival.
Oh, it absolutely is. Now, to all of our listeners, see, this is the caliber of folks who come to Woodstock, and also who you hear on Black Book Talk. So, you know, you support us by listening, but support them by coming out and greeting them when they come to town. But now, this is utterly self-serving, but I don't care. I am going to say that as I was looking through the acknowledgments, that apparently the title Voyage of the Sable Venus is dedicated, I believe you have with profound admiration,
yes.
I'm just reading your words, to the legacy
yes,
of Black librarianship and Black librarians worldwide. So since you were talking to two Black librarians today.
Exactly.
Now, how did we get so lucky? Because, you know, folks don't always remember to acknowledge us.
Oh.
Hint, hint. No.
No, I think I'm so happy you read that, because I didn't want to be self-serving and go, well, you know, I dedicated this to Black librarians. I'm so happy you noticed it. And actually, the real question is not that how did Black librarians get so lucky to have a book dedicated to them, but how did we get so lucky to have Black librarians in the world? That's really the true question. The legacy of Black librarianship, not just in the United States but worldwide, is so rich. I hope. Partly why I wanted to put it out there in my book is I hope to inspire so many people to look at this history. I mean, so we haven't talked about the title poem, which is a long poem that uses found titles of art and catalogs and art descriptions and, oh, you know, you name it, to reconstruct a narrative about the history of the Black female figure in Western art. But, you know, that poem and that the research I did to write that poem would never have been possible had it not been for the incredible work of archivists. I'm talking about over decades, if not centuries, right?
Yes.
Of, you know, taking care of printed matter and all kinds of ephemera and books and art and works on paper and paintings. I mean, you know, there's so many archives, there's so many repositories, there's so many libraries that have our history lying in dust. And were it not for Black librarians, and librarians on a whole, I understand, trust me, there, I know it's not just Black librarians who have helped to kind of preserve this history, but in particular, Black librarians began to do collecting and archiving long before it was fashionable, you know, long before anybody cared about it. So, for example, to piggyback to New Orleans, my next few books, the book I'm working on now is about colonial Louisiana and the history of poetry and photography, Black poetry and Black photography. And one of my cousins down there, we're talking 20 years ago, I've been working on this book for 2 decades, we were out in a parish at this courthouse, and the man who ran the courthouse brought out three volumes of 18th century books. We didn't have to apply. We didn't have to wear gloves. We didn't have to anything. And he drops them on the table, and dust and pages, the pages are crumbling before our very eyes.
Oh.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Sometimes it's a rescue mission. Go on.
Absolutely. I love that you use that word, because I do feel that librarians and people who are interested in African-American history and African diasporic history have been on a rescue mission. You know, there are material and visual objects and printed matter and literary objects that do need rescuing. When Katrina happened in New Orleans, I still have not been to New Orleans since Katrina, because I haven't quite been able to integrate what has happened. And as much as my family, most of whom had to be airlifted and were moved out, but also what happened to the archives there is deeply disturbing to me. You know, I mean, it's our history, and this is the rub about, you know, being colonized by the French, because the French colonized like no other. People like to pretend it wasn't that bad. It was that bad and more. But they were also meticulous record keepers. So, for example, I have records of my family that says not only, you know, what their names were. I'm talking about slaves. My family also owned slaves, and that's a complicated legacy as well. Black people own slaves, right?
Yeah.
But I have records of the names of relatives who were slaves. Not only do I have their names, I have their occupations. Not only do I have their occupations, I have what they did in Senegambia before they came to the United States.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's because the French were so meticulous with their record keeping. And that is why Louisiana, one of the many reasons why Louisiana and other kind of French colonies at the time were so important, because the archives are rich with material we can't get anywhere else.
And
right?
Yes.
So it's very complicated.
Well, we learn something new every day.
Yeah, I do want to mention, I just heard something recently about the United Nations getting involved and having some sanctions against the countries that went in and ransacked Timbuktu. And I just thought, oh my gosh. So I don't know, for some reason, I just wanted to share with people that happened. Yeah. And at least someone is saying this is a crime. It is a crime to destroy these ancient works and this ancient history. And I'm going to stop, because Emma, it's your turn for a question, but that just...
Can I just respond to that quickly, though, because it piggies back to Emmett's question and the discussion we had about joy and pleasure. One of the things that I try to do in my work is to hold loss and tragedy in two ways. One is, without doubt, to stare at it squarely in the eyes and say, this is beyond tragic. It is unspeakable what has taken place. Another way I try to look at it, in order to just get out of bed in the mornings and also to try to do good work, is to reposition myself in the world and say what it means to be of the diaspora for me now, not saying for everyone, just for me, is to be without a floor and to be without a home. Mm-hmm. And that could also be a tremendous site of agency. Right. If I don't come from anywhere, it could be that I come from everywhere. And so therefore, I can claim the whole world as my own. And that's a new way that I've begun to position myself when I work. Therefore, I can say and do anything. Right. It all belongs to me. I inherit it all. And so that's I just want to put that out there, because I don't necessarily accept this woe is me tragic kind of legacy as being the end-all and be-all. Our history is far vaster than the inception of the United States, certainly. And therefore, I try very hard to always remember that we come from a dynamic history that touched every continent on the planet.
All right.
Because with that kind of attitude, we become fearless. We aren't afraid to go anywhere or do anything.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, have less than 2 minutes left. We want to give you the last word. Well, you the last word in this interview, and we'll make one announcement after. It's about a local event. But anything you want to share with Portland before you go?
I love Portland. And when I first went there, the only time I went there, I felt very much at home, speaking of home. And I really would love to see you all come out for the Portland Word Woodstock. I thought that Emmett had a question, and I didn't want to cut him off. I'm sorry. I'd rather.
It was kind of a conversation. I will just let it go. I'm from Claiborne Parish, and I was going to talk a little bit about people from the Gambia and Senegal. A lot of descendants are in that area. Absolutely. Well, now we aren't there anymore because we keep going other places.
Yes, ma'am. I have to say I'm so honored that I'm talking to librarians and book people for a show about Black books. Thank you so much. I'm deeply honored, and I'm glad that you saw the dedication in the back of the book to Black librarianship, because certainly we would not know so much without you all. So thank you.
And we are honored that you're here. And we say to everyone who's listening, there's so many questions we didn't get to. There's so many conversational avenues we could have gone down. Yes. So you got to come on up and meet her and ask those questions. But before we close, we do have to say that the annual Children's Book Fair, A Free Book for Every Child, and They Choose Their Own, is taking place this Saturday, October 3rd, rain or shine, because we have tents, from 11 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library. So everybody, bring your children. Let them earn their books by making bookmarks and talking to bookman and bookwoman. It's going to be a great day. And on that happy note, we leave you. And we will welcome you back in October. So for Black Book Talk, the library lady, Patricia Welch, is saying have a great month.
See you in November.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
But the things I've been knowing, when that makes the tall grass thin.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Thursday, October 1st, 2015. I'm John Schock. We have this breaking news from Roseburg, Oregon. There was a mass shooting today at around 10:30 a.m. at Umpqua Community College. The news services are reporting that at least 10 people have been killed and at least 20 wounded on the 100-acre campus. Again, a mass shooting in Roseburg, Oregon. The numbers we are reporting may be higher. As of midnight Thursday,